Now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Mr. Welch, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Sorry for the confusion on the dates. My haste to get our agenda out missed the correct date, so apologies for everybody for that. We'll be fixing that going forward. As traditional, we'll go through the quick roll call. Then look at the agenda and ask anyone if they want to review or amend the agenda. Eric, it sounds like you may have one item, an actual exposure that occurred. Maybe we want to focus on that today.
Since we don't know what the actual forensic analysis is.
Okay. Well, then we'll probably then get right into the control spreadsheet feedback. But let's get to that a little bit later after roll. So, again, as traditional, if I'm going to call everyone's name out, if you don't hear me call your name, please let me know. I've got Mike Pelage, Jonathan Frakes, Derek Andre, Mikey O'Connor, Eric Brenner-Williams, and Joe Sauer. Did I miss anyone? All right, fantastic. Does anybody have a desire to amend the agenda? The purpose of this call is to go over the control worksheet that was distributed yesterday. That's the latest copy. But if there are any comments or changes or other desires for the meeting time, please let me know. Okay, silence is usually good. So, did everyone get a copy? I sent out yesterday an email that contained really three items. The first item was in the body of the email. It was a paragraph that we worked together on as a group late last week and early this week on what potentially could be included in draft applicant guidebook version 4 describing the HSTLD progress. The second two items were contained as attachments. There is a Word document that is an update of the development snapshot material. The first development snapshot, as the group knows, was released round about the Nairobi time. This development snapshot is meant to be released for Brussels. And it includes an appendix section that was included as an Excel spreadsheet, which is essentially the control worksheet that we've been working on. So that's the package that was sent out. Does anyone have any questions on that? Okay. So before we dig into the actual controls themselves, does anyone have any questions on the control worksheet, the controls, the mechanisms for how it works, and the like? What I'd like to do is really get an idea of where the actual concerns are before we start just drilling into, you know, one by one, talking about the sections and so forth. I'll give everyone a minute to sort of digest, maybe flip through and get off mute and so forth.
It's a kind of question that could have been asked 15 or so minutes earlier in mail rather than synchronously within the call.
Is that you, Eric? Is that your question about printing?
No, it's a comment about, in response to your asking if anyone has any questions, the subject isn't trivial, so providing time to think about the issue before asking or expecting answers. Basically, within the synchronous experience of a telephone call, it's difficult to get a complex answer to a complex question. You tend to get simple answers to complex questions when you do that.
Correct. I just haven't got any comment or feedback either way, so I'm hoping to spark dialogue. That's the nature of the question. Okay. So we went through Principle 1 a couple of weeks ago, and we began to go through Principle Number 2, So let me just flip here to our little Adobe Connect here. All right. And I'll get us down to principle number two with a little magnification so we can see what's going on. Bear with me here. Okay. Does everyone have access to the Adobe Connect?
I'm looking at your attachment you sent out with Lynn.
Oh, that'll work too. Is that Lynn?
Yeah.
Hey, Lynn, that'll work too. The difficulty for me is on the Adobe Connect, I can't see the page numbers. But principle number two, which occurs of roughly like maybe a quarter of the way through, a little further. And the principle is that the registry maintains effective controls to provide reasonable assurance that the processing of core registry functions are authorized, accurate, complete, and performed in a timely manner in accordance with the established policies and standards. And then there's a second qualifier there, that the identity of participating entities is established and authenticated. So in here, we have a variety of control objectives. Let me look at the total count here.
That font size is kind of tough. Any chance it could be made just a little bigger?
Yeah, sure. Let me see. How is that? Is that a little better?
That's okay. A little better. Thanks.
I'll do a little more as well. There we go. And I'll have to bounce a little bit back and forth so they can fit the relevant material on the screen. Okay. So let's go through, I think the best thing to do at this point is to go through the specific criteria objective and its corresponding illustrative control examples. We can sort of gloss over those unless someone wants to dig in deep. There's a good description of how these various columns work in the Word document that I sent out, and it follows what we've been talking about sort of in the previous technical calls. In general...
Which Word document? I replied to you just a few minutes before the call began, that your mail on the 9th contained a PDF and an XLS.
Right, mail on the 9th was...
doc document.
Right, the mail on the 9th was superseded. Let me get back to the actual time and date for you.
I looked at all subsequent, and I found nothing that contained a enclosure that wasn't...
The mail on the 9th was superseded a little bit by yesterday's mail, Eric. It was the 11th at 12:44 p.m. That probably would have been Pacific time, I think, is how this Outlook web access.
And the title is New Guidebook Paragraph.
That's it.
All right. That's it.
So if you click on that, there's a little Excel in there. If you click on that, that's sort of the latest, greatest material. And that's the one that I have up on the Adobe Connect as well. Okay. So the most important areas, I think, to focus on for today's call, if we don't have any additional or specific questions, are the HSTLD specific criteria objectives. And I don't know if you can see the little hand, but I've got sort of outlining that now. And then their corresponding illustrative control examples. So these objectives are meant to be very specific objectives that are actionable, that are basically the requirements of the HSTLD program. That's these guys here. So in this case, it's procedures exist to verify the validity of registry operator and or back-end registry service provider candidates according to defined requirements. We've qualified that a little bit with some examples. That's under the illustrative control examples. But it's important to note, and I do this within the document itself, and I also do it in the development snapshot, it's important to note that these are just examples. An actual TLD could have their own control activities provided they adequately met the objectives defined here in the criteria.
And when we speak to that very issue, are we speaking to replicating some auditory formalism, or are we speaking to the actual results of the auditory activity?
So what we're speaking, let me see if I can qualify that a little bit, Eric. There is an objective criteria here that basically says to be an HSTLD, you need to meet the following objectives, right? We've provided some examples over here on the right, these illustrative control examples, that a representative or sample TLD might do to meet that objective. Now, the qualified assessor of a registry will have to go ahead and look at what the registry has in place in terms of their specific control activities and determine if they actually meet these objectives. So when you talk about sort of the audit process, that would be sort of the qualified third-party assessor, right, whether it's an auditor or a type of vehicle.
If I understand this correctly, that means that an operator would not be limited to these illustrative controls?
Correct.
If they had one or two different controls or something that's not listed here, that could be considered.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And the idea there is, the market itself it provides tolerance for the market, if you will, to define creative control activities and environments that are appropriate for them yet still meet these specific objectives. It would be incumbent on the TLD to make that case, and also incumbent on the third-party assessor to agree with that position.
When you finish, Andy, I'd like to continue my question.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Eric. Yeah, please take the floor. And in fact, if we have additional questions, we should probably build up a quick queue. Mike.
If Laura's finished.
No, Lynn. I'm sorry. I thought you were done, Eric.
Actually, what you answered, Andy, sorry, Lynn, was you spoke to the formal function of auditing. That is, if the auditor was satisfied that the audit activity, but that doesn't speak to the actual quality of the thing which is audited. So to make it very simple, because when we're talking to each other, simplicity helps. If we have some property, which and high secure zone manager is supposed to obtain, are we interested only in the formal function of auditing something, or are we interested in the results of that audit? So if the registry has, to pick Whois, the wonderful Whois example, if the registry has perfect Whois data, is that a substitute for a perfect Whois audit, which may or may not actually result in perfect data?
Let me try to answer that correctly, and give me feedback if I'm going off the wrong path here. So what we're really auditing here is the control environment at the TLD.
But the controls are there for a purpose. Do we care about the purpose or only about the process without any results?
Well, we care about both. But we're auditing the activities against these criteria.
That's the very point I'm raising, is whether or not we're auditing an activity, or if what we're doing is merely auditing without concern to the outcome, or if the outcome itself is proof of the audit.
No, the outcome itself would not be proof of the audit.
So we can have arbitrarily good data for Whois, and we could say that it does not meet the criteria of being good because the audit function is not good, And we could have an arbitrarily good audit function for arbitrarily bad data, who is data again. And we could say that was good because the audit process was good even though the data was bad.
What we're doing is we're defining the control environment that needs to be in place to be considered a high-security TLD, right?
That's so you're not interested in the actual result. That's not something which is within the realm of knowledge. You can't know the outcome. You can only you're only interested in the
Well, we're interested in the security controls and practices that are in place within the TLD, Eric. That's when it comes down to it. Security really is the disciplined following of good practice.
I'm not going to agree with any open-ended definition of what security is. I mean, that's I'm trying to figure out simply. If the only thing that we can use to measure the service model that we are attempting to define is it excludes the knowledge that we obtain from directly observing the registry itself.
Eric, if I could just offer a comment here, I believe in measurement and metrics myself, and I do think that we need to have meaningful ways to measure whether or not these objectives or criteria are adequately met. So the way I'm thinking about this, and I certainly wouldn't say my thought process is perfect, but I'm thinking that on the right, the control examples provide specifics of ways that people can meet each one of these objectives, but at the same time, it's not limiting an organization to these examples. Which I kind of like that idea because, again, over time, you know, there may be new approaches or innovative ways to address this. And I do think trying to develop this in a way that's sustainable is important.
Right. I think that's a key concept. And Eric, just to sort of get back to that, the concept of sustainability is really a very key concept. So if we were to come in and do a quality assessment of data at a TLD, we could only ever do that for a specific point in time because as soon as we were done with our assessment, things could change, right?
Things will change.
That's right. That's a given. That's a given. So the theory really is, or the thought, I mean, I won't say theory, that's probably too strong a word, but the thought is that if we build an appropriate control environment around the TLD, we're reducing the risk that bad things will happen, including the data getting out of whack, if you will, as an approach to handle a duration or time or a longer period of time. Is it an absolute guarantee? No. None of these types of programs are general absolute or are absolute guarantees. But the idea is that we're providing an appropriate construct for an environment that improves or is meant to improve the entire process.
I appreciate that it's meant to improve, and it may actually. But my point, and I'm sorry I've spoken so long to this, so I'll stop with this one point. Can we discern the difference between co-op and comm?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, presumably COM is not a highly secure zone.
Okay, that's assumption number one. COM is not highly secure. Okay.
For some value of secure. I'm sure someone on the call would be happy to point out some aspect of COM which is contrary to their notion of what security is. But we might be very hard-pressed to find an instance of any of the offered absences or lacks of security in the co-op registry. So can we tell them apart? And if we can't, are we building something that's useful?
I'm not sure. So I think...
Well, let's just pick on the hoary old Whois data, you know, for a moment. Let's suppose that some percent of the Whois data for .com is bogus. Whether it's 20 or 80, I really don't care.
Right.
The Whois data for co-op is, well, it might be as bad as 1%. But that's probably just an accident of people not changing their phone numbers when they change their telephones. But if we can't tell the difference between those two things, then is our tool useful when we assert that Whois accuracy has some relevance to high security? Just to take that terrible example.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can, having not measured each environment and measured it against each it against them. I don't know if I can make those assertions.
Well, it's not about you and your measurement. It's about, let us assert that there is some 20% or 80% of incorrectness in the Whois data for .com and 1% or 0% for the same data in co-op. Neither of us is measuring it. Other people have. If we can't discern the difference between those two, then what is the utility of the control?
Oh, well, you know, I think let's turn that around a bit. I think, you know, let's take as an assumption now one of the two of those entities elected to become HSTLD, and they elected to build a control environment that supported these requirements.
Okay, let's say Calm did, and they still have garbage data.
Well, then we'd have to probably include our improve our program, I think. But the idea is now we would have a yardstick that's this program, with which we could have those dialogues against actual data that's transparent to the community. So I don't have an ability. I don't have a yardstick today that I could appropriately guess with. One of the advantages of implementing this structure is that, presumably, once it's implemented, we would. And we'd be able to ask those questions. You know, is the control environment sufficient? Because if it is, then we shouldn't have those types of failures. If it is not, then we may have those failures, and we'd have to go back and improve our control environment requirements, right?
Well, when I think abstractly about what a high secure zone might be, which we're not finished with by any means, it seems to me likely that if we come up with a achievable definition, that there are actually several registries that already manifest all of the properties that we're seeking, co-op being one of them, CAP being another, museum being a third. If we are concerned with results, not necessarily if we're concerned only with the repetitive auditory function or the repeatability of measurement, but with the measured. I'll stop there. Thank you for your time.
Okay, Eric, if I can work on this, maybe even take it offline, whatever I can do to sort of provide context we can do going forward. So I'm going to run quickly through the specific criteria objectives. We've got about a half hour left. I'm not going to gloss over the illustrative control examples unless they're an NA, again, because the control examples that we drove wherever possible in this first draft were from external sources. You can see the external source in this control example reference. In fact, let me pull this over a little bit. And the NAs, again, are reflective of controls activities that I couldn't reference from anywhere else, so I had to sort of make them up, if you will. So obviously very concerned about those and would like feedback on them. So the first one is, you know, procedures exist to verify the validity of registry operator and our back-end registry service provider candidates according to defined requirements. The first example is, and it's an NA, is the HSTLD sponsor should verify the background of the principles for the candidate registry operator and or back-end registry service provider are made available on the website or on request. So again, this is about the provingness publicly. that's part of the component of trust that we've defined for the program. There's additional ones that come from WebTrust EV, so that's extended validation WebTrust requirements 1.1. It's about verifying, these controls are all about verifying individuals within the TLD. And again, I won't read each of them, but over for homework, if the group could sort of look at those and raise any concerns, then that would be fantastic. There's another NA here. The HSTLD sponsor should verify the candidate registry operator and or backend registry service provider's email address and validate whether it is monitored and designated as the main email address for the candidate registry operator and or backend registry service provider's business. This is, in the realm of the control environment, this is important should there need to be any action taken because bad acting is occurring within a TLD. This becomes a very important control.
We have the word sponsor there again.
What do you, Eric, suggest as alternate language?
Well, sponsor was appropriate in the 2001 through 2004 process.
Okay.
Balaj will chime in and say that we still need language that covers both historic registry applicants who were successful and prospective registry applicants who are not yet able to apply. And there's two things. I have two answers to your question, or two parts of it. One is registry operator is the contractual party that has a contract with ICANN. The other part of my answer is, I think what we're doing is we're resurrecting the registry backend services provider program that was surfaced by staff last year and killed rather quietly for, quote, business reasons, end quote. And I really wish that hadn't occurred because this addresses the capabilities of the backend services provider as a someone who's not invisible to ICANN. Currently, CORE has no contract with ICANN. We could be, people on the moon for all ICANN actually knows. Our contract is with NewsDelma and with Fondazione Punctcat, not with us. So looking to the back-end services provider, it seems like we're resurrecting the program that got started and killed last year. So that's the second half of my answer. I think this should be applicant rather than sponsor because it's not yet a registry operator, nor is it the back-end provider.
Does that fit, so for existing TLDs, would that fit for existing TLDs?
They're applicant for this magic star on their web front.
Right. Okay. I got you. So I can make that change. The HSTLD.
I have a question there. What about the scenario of someone who becomes a TLD and does not elect to go into this program initially, and then let's say maybe a year after they're in operation, they decide they want this. They're not going to be an applicant anymore.
They'll be an applicant for this program. It won't be an applicant for a GTLD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was my question, too. And then when Eric started describing that, it made sense. So why don't I change this to HSTLD program applicant instead of HSTLD?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then there's a lot of changes throughout the document on that one, so I can get that tuned up. Okay. Good catch. Again, we've got some WebTrust stuff in here. WebTrust happens to have a very good section on how to do some of this background checking and so forth. There's another NA here. HSTLD sponsor should verify whether the articles of incorporation of the candidate registry operator and/or backend registry service provider specify the purpose of the organization, organization's name, place of business, and key officers. That's, again, sort of good practice about proving these things. Now, again, be mindful that these these activities are illustrative examples. It is possible that it doesn't apply to all DLDs, and there's a different avenue of proof or a different but similar control activity that would need to take place for a specific TLD.
What is the certificate of formation?
The article of incorporation, you mean?
Well, if there's a lawyer nearby, they'd probably point out that many companies exist for any lawful purpose, and that is sort of the sum total of their statement of purpose.
Hey, this is John McElwain. I just joined, by the way, and I'm a lawyer.
Hi, John.
I don't know if Michael's on the call, but yeah, I mean, it could be there could be limited liability companies or partnership agreements that we should probably reference or something like that.
Well, actually, I think this is asking for you to paint your client into a corner and say that they can only make money on Tuesdays or something, so, as opposed to just their any lawful purpose.
I'm sorry, I thought the question was that it was just referring to articles of incorporation, not trying to paint anybody into a corner.
That's correct.
Okay.
And be mindful, again, what we've tried to do in the illustrative control examples here is provide an example. There certainly could be entities in the future that may not even have articles of incorporation, right? They may have an equivalent type of structure that they would need to do to operate this. But this is sort of an example of one activity that could be in place.
This is Paul Smoser. I think the core issue here is trying to establish the legitimacy of the applicant, right?
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
They're valid and existing organization and not someone who's just kind of popped up out of nowhere?
That's correct. And if we back up to the actual control, the criteria standard, it is procedures exist to verify the validity of registry operator and or back-end registry service provider candidates according to defined requirements. So it's all to support that standard objective.
And we've had some problem, I know, I won't name any names, but there's been some litigation, and I think in Florida where there was some registries that were sort of playing a little bit of a shell game with who they were legally in terms of legal entities.
Registries or registrars?
Actually, registrars, excuse me.
Right. That's a much wilder playpen. We had the experience last year. Finding the Democratic Republic of the Congo was an exceedingly interesting exercise.
I can't even imagine. That must have been so that's probably a good example of, you know, an entity that may be valid but may have different controls than we're illustrating here, right?
Well, it was just unfindable until we actually got to Singapore.
Very cool. Okay, I'm gonna keep flipping through. I think we're getting to goodness on this stuff. The next NA is HSTLD sponsor should verify the certificate of formation for the candidate registry operator and/or backend registry service provider, and validate whether it has been made available by the candidate registry operator and/or backend registry service provider. Again, I'll change the language of sponsor here, Eric, but it says now the HSTLD sponsor, so it will read.
Wait.
The HSTLD
How does this add to what the existing GTLD application process, both in the historic 2000 through 2004 round and in the current round? I mean, how are we extending that? We probably know where VeriSign actually is, and we probably know where many of the existing registries are. And the applicant for this program, whether they're an applicant contemporaneous with their application for a GTLD or subsequent to their application for a GTLD, both the registry operator and the back-end services provider, if distinct legal entities, are known to the application process. So what are we adding?
How often does that change?
That's something you want to throw at counsel. I can counsel and ask, are you guys catching this? Can people actually change things without notice? And I think currently the answer is no. I have to notice counsel when I change the name server.
So the answer I would say is that's the answer. The answer is, first of all, we want to make sure that there's a control in place that catches that and notifies the right organizations. And remember, to maintain an HSTLD to be an HSTLD in good standing, you will need to have this control audited on a somewhat regular basis. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing, to your point, Eric, is, you know, maybe this is already a control that exists. If that's the case, it should be easy to prove this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I just think it may be easy to prove.
Right. I just don't want us to redo work that is done already either in the DAG or in the external to DAG existing, well, we don't have a word for it, I suppose, the rules of the road for mariners, the rules that Chuck and friends obey, the rules that I obey, and the rules that are pending for applicants.
Right, and I think the key there is, you know, my litmus test is there's two things. First of all, if they're already doing it, it should be easy for them to prove it. And second is there is, I think, incremental value in regularly checking the appropriate operation of these things. Okay, the next one is the HSTLD sponsor, and again, change the language, should verify whether the organizational charter documents have been made available by the candidate registry operator under backend registry service provider and specify statement of purpose, organization's name, affiliation, principals or officers, and then criteria for the principals or officers for holding office. Any question on that one? I'm going to start going through this a little faster, only because they're all similar. I won't read in detail, but the next one looks at the business license and some attributes about that. We then look at the proof of filed DBA, the DBA certificate. We looked at some trade name and the trade name registration. That's the next control activity. We look at partnership agreements, and we have some attributes of those agreements. Very interesting. I'll pull that up just for a second. These are generally the interesting things within a partner agreement that we'd want to look at. And then we get down to our next control, our next criteria standard. So the next criteria standard is the HSTLD sponsor should verify that the registry operator and or backend registry service provider's insurance status or equivalent liability coverage is in accordance with defined locale requirements. Okay, so this is about insurance.
Oh, good. I'm glad you got locale in there.
Yeah. I think actually, Eric, I might have changed that on a conversation we had. You began to make me realize that I had to kind of broaden this out a little bit. And I tried to do that throughout the doc.
Yeah, buying insurance in Delaware is really different from buying insurance in Johannesburg.
Yeah, and you know, again, the illustrative control examples will probably be locale specific because I had to give some specific example of an activity. But again, these are areas that could be different, and it should be different for the locale in which we're evaluating. First one's from WebTrust EV. Again, they've got some really good controls there in WebTrust stuff. So is the second one. So really, the coverage here we get primarily from WebTrust EV. So again, please have a look at that. If you have any questions, let me know. We then get into the next control criteria, rather. The HSTLD applicant should verify that the registry operator and our backend registry service provider candidate's financial account status is in accordance with defined requirements. So we're trying to get comfortable that they're financially valid, if you will. The first one here is an NA, and what we're saying is The HSTLD applicant should verify whether a financial capability review has been made available by the candidate registry operator and/or back-end registry service provider, and that the financial capability review should be performed by an independent verified accountant showing the candidate registry operator and/or back-end registry service provider's finances are sufficient to administer the objectives identified in the Articles of Incorporation and Charter documents. So we're doing a little triangulation here and trying to make sure that this process step, more than anything, has occurred and has occurred correctly. That's sort of a good litmus test to check that out. The next one gives a couple of options. They're both from, again, WebTrust EV, and they talk about demand deposit accounts and so forth, so some instruments that could be used to bolster that criteria. This, I would assume, would be somewhat locale specific as well throughout the world.
Oh, yeah.
I don't pretend to be an expert in that, but, those elements could be different.
Right. We just have to not pretend that everyone's doing business in Delaware.
Yes. And what I tried to do very specifically, the reason I broke this spreadsheet, Eric, into this with this nice little black line here is to try to make it as crystal clear as I could to the reader. You know, the stuff on the left, this stuff, is the requirements. The stuff on the right is just examples, and UTLD will probably be different at least some of these examples, right?
Yep.
Okay. The next criteria is the HSTLD sponsor should revalidate their registry operator and or back-end registry service provider candidates every 2 years according to defined requirements. That 2 years is, I'll tell you now, is somewhat arbitrary, I believe. But so if there's violent disagreement there, I won't be able to push back very hard. But it seemed to be a practical period in accordance with perhaps a 2 year revalidation of these requirements by an independent assessor.
Well, two is less than five. Therefore,
right.
even if everything we were doing was testing what ICANN presently tests, this would be a higher standard because it is more frequent.
Correct. Exactly right. The control activity here just sort of qualifies this statement. That's an NA, but it really just qualifies the criteria statement.
So every 2.5 years, if I can, if our basic contractual period is 5 years or 10 years or a multiple of five, one or more multiples of five, then splitting that in half rather than giving us odd numbers, 2, 2, 1, so
you're thinking, so my logic here was the HSTLD, HSTLDs should be reassessed every 2 years. And that's a question. I threw that out there because a year seemed to be too frequent and 3 years seemed to be too long. This sort of dovetails with that timeline. Are there any strong thoughts from the group about that time period?
Well, I wouldn't want to jump through a hoop. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, Eric, please go.
Thank you, Michael. Let us suppose that I have a contract for 5 years for Dot Bank.
Right.
Or with Dot Bank robbers. So on year two, we do we run through an audit. And on year four, we run through an audit. And on year five, we run through an ICANN audit rather than an HSTLD audit. And then on year six, we run through an HSTLD audit. So years four, five, and six are non-fun for me. If we tie this to 50% of whatever it is that general counsel finally sells us all as part of the contract for the dot bank or dot bank robber, then every other audit is at the same time as a contract renewal or contract negotiation.
Right. Easing your burden, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Thanks, Eric. So, Andy, today on the registry constituency call, ICANN staff gave a briefing on the proposed registry failover program. Are you aware of this particular initiative?
I'm aware of the initiative, but totally not tuned up on it, Mike.
Okay, so the reason I'm raising this was during today's call, ICANN stated that they would be identifying a primary sort of fail-safe registry infrastructure provider and then a secondary in case there was a conflict. I guess the question that I'm asking here is, it seems like these people are almost going to have to qualify for the high security because would it make sense, though, would it, if the failover from a high security goes to a non-high security failover provider, correct?
That's actually a great question. I could see, so let's take the examples. So if both were high security verified, then we'd be in good shape, right? You'd hand off to from one to the other, and you'd still maintain your high security badge or whatever it is we ultimately come up with. In the instance that one was not, so the one that was operating was not, and it transferred to one. It transferred to one that was not. You would then lose your high security zone badge of honor for the period of time that the TLD transferred to the one that was not, right? Being mindful that the high security zone badge of honor doesn't link directly to the contract to be a TLD. It just means you lose your badge of honor for that period.
Registry failure, though, is failure.
I'm sorry, Eric. I'll let you finish your question.
It wasn't the question so much as the comment. I was on the registry failover project about a year ago. I wasn't on today's call. When a registry fails and we need to pick up the pieces, it's not clear that we need to pick up that particular piece, that is, maintain the integrity of any particular property above the basics of the actual registrant data.
So, right. I mean, maybe is that a control criteria that once you fail, you automatically get it revoked? Maybe that's a criteria.
Well, the only concern I would raise with that one would be that I could see a registry failing for financial reasons that aren't necessarily linked to this control environment. That's the question.
Right.
So, in other words, they could be really, really well controlled, but financially a mess. So have a failure from that perspective. I guess what I'm asking, is there parity there between the failure modes and what we're asking for here?
And I guess my just the point I was just trying to raise, Andy, is let's just suppose, again, we have Dot Bank that is high security. It does the right thing. It's fails. Okay, if they were so secure that nobody actually was able to register in it or whatever, right? So when that fails, right? So it's so great that so few people register that it's a business failure.
Right.
So now what happens is ICANN, one of the obviously obligations that ICANN is looking to do in connection with this new GTLD process is protect registrants that invest in a particular TLD. So in that scenario, if there was the badge of honor, which registrants valued and thought was important, if it goes to one of these failover infrastructure providers that ICANN, and the reason I posed this question was you were talking about how frequently do you need to do this. On today's call, ICANN staff indicated that they were looking to award these failover contracts to infrastructure providers on a term of 5 years with a primary and then a secondary. So that was
gotcha.
Again, I won't talk anymore. This was just something where I wanted to interject based upon another ICANN call. You know, I saw another moving part over here and our moving part over here, and perhaps you could sit there and talk with the ICANN staff about how you may want to try to sync those two concepts up, and then sort of feedback to the group based upon what you hear from ICANN, and then, as a group, we could perhaps make a recommendation one way or the other once you find out, what ICANN's current thinking is in this area.
Mike, who's spearheading
this is Mikey.
That? Who's spearheading that from a staff perspective over here?
I think it was Francisco and Craig Schwartz. Were the two that gave the presentation to the registry constituency today on today's call.
Okay, I'll ping them. I'm in ICANN today, so I can ping them today.
This is Mikey.
Go, Mikey.
I just want to amplify what you just said, Mike. If I'm a registrant and I presumably pay a premium for an HSTLD and I put a lot of marketing around the fact that it's in an HSTLD and then the badge of honor winks out, I'm going to get really cranky. So I don't think that having the badge of honor get removed in that process is a real good idea. I think a much better idea would be to make sure that wherever the failed registry goes, it's also going to remain an HSTLD. Otherwise, the first time that one of these things winks out, registrants are going to go, oh, that's an interesting deal. I don't think I'm going to buy one of those again.
Yeah.
Great. So that's my only thought about that one. Great
good.
Point, Mike. Thanks.
Yeah, good question, guys. And perhaps we can extend that question into the next call.
Yep. I guess it's. Do you want to end it? Do you want to end up, or is there one or two more? You think you have time in 3 minutes to get through another block, or is this a break point?
I think it's a good break point. So Mike, I'll let you close the call, and then I'll see you all back on the next call. I will be on in just a minute. I have to take a quick break, but I'll be on in just a minute.
All right. We're done, and call back in for part two. In about 2 minutes. Talk to everyone then. Bye.
Bye-bye.